Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello, my wonderful audience. Wonderful, wonderful audience. This is an incredibly special day for me. You're looking at Vladimir Zev Zelenko, MD. Dr. Zelenko is a board-certified family physician. He is a hero. He's my hero. He's Ginger's hero. Because of him, when one of my family members came down with COVID-19, we knew how to treat them. We didn't treat them ourselves. We knew who to connect them to for hydroxychloroquine, which in New York State is supposed to be illegal just about, thanks to our dictator. And all that began with Zev Zelenko. He is the original spirit behind Peter McCullough, Dr. McCullough, whom you've seen on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, which you're watching or listening to now. And he has written a protocol that was inspired by Dr. Zelenko. And you've also seen on my show Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet, V-L-I-E-T. And you've also seen her on my shorter videos about the preventive care. And all of this goes back to Dr. Zelenko. And the other thing that he did is he gave hope. And when we thought about asking him to come on the show with us, and he consented, Ginger actually cried. I said, what's that feeling, honey? And she said, he gave me hope. When they were telling us we weren't allowed to treat people even, and that you couldn't get any treatment, we had to wait until the multi-billion dollar drug companies and their cutting edge, mafia type people, got us lousy drugs that cost a lot and dangerous vaccines that cost a lot. But Dr. Zelenko gave us alternatives that worked. And he's paid a price for that. And so you're a hero. And I can tell you, I haven't said that very often. I'm not sure I can remember saying that in my many years of doing this work. So I would like this to be an opportunity, not so much to tell people about how to get good treatment, although we could spend time on it. I mean, because that's all up on my YouTube, the Dr. Peter Breggin's YouTube channel, and it's on Breggin.com. It's coming from McCullough and from Dr. Vliet and Dr. McCullough. So I'd love to just do what you and I began to do a half an hour or so ago, and that is get to know you. Where you're from, how you got involved in all of this, religious, spiritual background, whether this was something you expected to do in your life or never expected to do. So welcome to my show. I'm just honored as I can be to have you here.
Thank you very much, and it's an honor to meet you as well. And you're a legend in your time. So, it's not about me, and I really would like to start off by acknowledging that I had very little to do with this. I really think that it was like divinely given as a gift, and I want to make sure that I properly give credit to where it's due, which is that the Creator had mercy on us and put some common sense ideas into my head, and then I was able to share them with others. I was born in Ukraine, in Kyiv, in 1973, and then my family emigrated to Brooklyn, New York, in 1978. I was 4 years old. And a Brooklyn boy, you know, raised, went to public school, junior high school, Midwood High School. I wasn't religious. My family was not observant at all. And, you know, they came to America looking for, you know, the pursuit of the American dream, which at that time meant, you know, the acquisition of material wealth, and also fleeing a anti-Semitic environment that they grew up in. So that's how that happened. And I went to Hofstra University undergraduate. I studied.
I think that's coming from your end, the clinging.
Yeah, I don't know how to turn it off, but I think we're going to need to just...
live with it?
Yeah.
All right.
My apologies. So... Yeah,
you were saying you went to Hofstra. That's on Long Island, folks. I grew up in Long Island.
I got a degree in chemistry. I actually graduated. I was number one in the university. I had a 3.99 GPA, and I got a scholarship to go to medical school. In my end of my third year. So what happened was I had a free year, in a sense, to pursue other interests. And so I knew I was Jewish, I knew I was Russian, I knew I was American, but I had no idea who I was. And I would say I had an existential crisis, because here I got what I wanted. I was on the top of the academic world, was accepted to medical school with a scholarship early. So, and I wasn't happy. And that was always surprising to me, because I had achieved my long-term goal at that time, and why wasn't I happy? So I started studying philosophy. And while I found it intellectually stimulating, it did not penetrate my heart. So at the end of my fourth year in college, I found out about a trip to go to Israel, like Birthright, it's called. It's like... For kids that never went to Israel before, it was just there was a sponsor who would pay for your trip. So honestly, I went to Israel just, you know, looking for girls. So I didn't. It wasn't meant to be a spiritual awakening, but that's what happened. And for the first time, I felt spirituality and began to look into mystical teachings and things that. I met a physicist. His name is Dr. Gerald Schroeder. Gerald Schroeder. He's a professor emeritus from MIT, a genius. He wrote a few books, and he was teaching in Jerusalem. He's a religious Jew. And I had a lot of questions. I was an atheist, self-professed atheist. My ponytail was the size of my beard. You know, I had ripped jeans. That was my look. And I started asking him questions, and he intellectually eviscerated me. And he showed me that my understanding of science is superficial, and my understanding of religion is non-existent. And it's the epitome of arrogance for me to come to any conclusion without my doing due diligence. I have to tell you, that was very humbling, because, you know, I had the God complex. I was top of my world, right? Young and stupid. So then I started exploring matters of the soul, and I've never looked back, I have to say. I felt a certain tranquility and inner peace that had eluded me for my childhood, and I've incorporated that. Well, that's become my identity, I would say, and everything else that I do is an expression of that. So I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a physician, I'm a friend, I'm a son. But all those are roles that I have are a manifestation of who I really am, which is, or who I'm trying to be, which is someone who serves God. So it's a work in progress. So that's kind of my, I guess, spiritual background. But I have 8 children, thank God. 4 boys, 4 girls. And I'm a family physician in, I was in a small community up in Monroe, New York. When I say small, I mean geographically small. It's only 1 square mile, but it had 35,000 people. So a very high population density. And in the first week of April, COVID arrived. And because of the close living conditions, it spread like a wildfire. And within the week, we had over 1,000 patients with active infection. And at that time, the whole world was focusing on building respirators and ICU and hospital capacity. And the treatment model that was suggested was the following. If a patient comes to your office and has COVID, you send them home for supportive care with Tylenol and fluids. And if and when he gets short of breath, they should go to the hospital. In the hospital, they'll get intubated. And in March, there was over 80% mortality rate on patients on respirators in the Manhattan hospitals, at least. So that didn't seem like a very good idea. So I thought to myself, well, why don't we do what we do in medicine, which is early intervention. I'm an outpatient physician. I work in the pre-hospital setting. My job is to keep people out of the hospital. So that's what I wanted to do. So it just made sense to me to put out the fire when it's a small fire, not a big fire. You know, if someone has cancer, God forbid, you don't wait for it to become metastatic. You treat it when it's contained. So if you look at influenza, for example, the CDC guidelines are to start antiviral treatments within 48 hours, because that's when antiviral treatments are most effective. No, but when it came to COVID-19, we weren't permitted, or it wasn't advocated that we treat these patients. We would send them home and let the infection get out of control. So I started doing research. First of all, I needed to read up on this virus, what RNA viruses are. I've learned it, but you know, it's not something I deal with every day. And then I looked around what other countries were doing. So I looked, it started in Far East, so I wanted to know how they treated it. And I saw that they'd been using, especially the South Koreans, using zinc and hydroxychloroquine with some moderate success for inpatients. And then I looked in France, Dr. Didier Raoul in Marseille, France, and he was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, also in hospitalized patients with some minor success. So these are all drugs that I've been extremely familiar with. Well, first of all, zinc is just a mineral and an element, whatever. But azithromycin is the most common antibiotic probably used in family medicine. And then hydroxychloroquine, I had an unusually high number of patients with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, and patients that traveled to malaria endemic areas of the world. So that was a drug that I'd used, I don't know, a few hundred times, I would say, over my career. So I knew, you know, these are all simple drugs. So I decided, okay, let's make a cocktail here. Let's put everything together and let's see what happens, because I had nothing else. And the rationale, there was a scientific basis for what I was thinking about, which is everyone knows that zinc is good for viral infections, but the actual mechanism is beautiful. It inhibits an enzyme that is involved in RNA replication. So in order for a virus to replicate its genetic material and spread, it's a parasite. It needs to get into a cell and harness the cell's metabolic machinery in order to make more copies of itself. And one of those steps is an enzyme called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, which is involved in making copies of RNA for offspring viruses. The problem was, it turns out that zinc throws a monkey wrench in that mechanism. But the problem with zinc, there was a biochemical reason why it could not get into a cell, because the cell membrane is cholesterol-like, lipophilic, phospholipid bilayer for the doctors. And zinc is a cation in solution. It has a charge. So it's like oil and water. The two couldn't go through. So it turns out that hydroxychloroquine opens a door, a canal, and allows for the zinc to go from outside the cell to inside the cell where the virus is, where the enzyme is. So the analogy I started to use was a gun and a bullet, that zinc is the bullet and hydroxychloroquine is the gun that delivers the bullet to the place it needs to go. Now, there were a lot of studies done with hydroxychloroquine that didn't work. And there were a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons was they were using it without zinc. It would be by way of analogy, me giving you an unloaded gun and you making a conclusion that the gun doesn't shoot. Well, it didn't shoot because you didn't have the required equipment that you need to use in synergy. And the antibiotic azithromycin was basically there as a bulletproof vest to protect the lungs from secondary pneumonias. It also turns out it has some antiviral properties. But the point is, the second I started using it, my patients got better. They stopped going to the hospital. And I said, wow, this is something amazing. And they would get significantly better within a day. So people were having shortness of breath, a pulse ox oxygenation level in the 80s, within a day were breathing unassisted. So I said, oh, okay, this is amazing. And I realized what I found. I'm not a researcher, but I'm not stupid either. And I realized, by way of analogy, a frontline soldier finds a map with the enemy location. And he realizes that that information will help win the war, but we need to get that information to the five-star general. And how do I do that? So I asked my son, my 17-year-old son, to help me make a YouTube video, because I'd never made a YouTube video. And it was addressed to the President of the United States. And I said, Mr. President, I really need to talk to you. This is what I'm seeing. And I put it out there. 16 hours later, I get a phone call from Mark Meadows, the President's Chief of Staff, on my cell phone. You can ask how I got my cell phone, but that's a different conversation. And he wanted to know, you know, that what I needed to talk to the president about, what was I doing. So I told him. He seemed interested. But it was in the very beginning. I only had less than 100 patients. It was the very beginning of the pandemic. So he told me to keep him updated with my observations, which I did. A week later, I got a phone call from Dr. Stephen Hahn, the commissioner of the FDA. He wanted to know what I was doing, and then he got me connected with some high-up people in the NIH. And honestly, that was a dead end, because I spoke to them, and they had no way of taking real-world evidence and integrating it in any way to use it to set policy or standard of care. They were very caught in their ways with the standard clinical trials, and there was no mechanism in place to take real world experience and convert that into policy. And that resulted in the death of a few hundred thousand people that shouldn't have died, but that's a different conversation. So then
let me interrupt for a second, and then maybe a little later on, or we could talk about. But basically, my impression is that they could not do their huge push programs to give billions of dollars to the drug companies to push through fake, really bad drugs like remdesivir and experimental vaccines if there was an effective treatment. Quote, an effective treatment, they could not invoke the emergency measures. So I just think it was a matter of sacrificing America to the big global industries and to their own power and stuff. But I don't know whether you want to get into that at all, but I think it was deeper than they couldn't take your kind of evidence. Your kind of evidence would have destroyed their program because the Emergency Act states if there are no effective, safe and effective treatments.
Right, so I'm aware of that. And that's part of the reason why there was such opposition. It goes much deeper than that, which I'd like to talk about. But
Go on, though. I want to hear about your, what comes next, folks, is pretty stunning. So in the story, so I'd like you to go on with your story. You'd gotten a call from the White House, and then you tried to talk. And you actually got to talk to the head of the FDA. I mean, all this is quite remarkable. Go ahead.
He called me on my cell phone. And then Rudy Giuliani called me. And I did a podcast with him for an hour. And that podcast went viral. It was seen millions of times. And that changed my life forever. All of a sudden, I was getting phone calls from heads of state in different countries, from governments, all wanting to hear what I was doing, and doctors from all around the world, and then patients from all around the world. And it was very emotionally difficult because, especially with the patients calling, everyone was desperate. Save my father, save my husband, save my wife, pleading for my time. I was working 21-hour days, trying to juggle everything. And in the middle of all this, I have to give you some background information to understand why I was predisposed to discovering this treatment. 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with pulmonary artery sarcoma. It's an extremely rare cancer. Most people have never heard about it. Maybe 10 cases a year. Worldwide, it's 100% lethal. It's always found at autopsy. I was having difficulty breathing, and my wife made me go to the doctor. I ended up having a CAT scan. They thought it was a pulmonary embolism. I was put on blood thinning medication. A month later, I started coughing up blood. I started drowning in my own blood and ended up back in the hospital. They did another CAT scan. They said the blood clot was worse. And they recommended doing a thrombectomy. My kids. Basically to have open heart surgery and to remove the blood clot. I agreed and had surgery, but during the surgery they discovered it wasn't a blood clot, but it was this tumor. And the tumor had spread to my right lung and completely destroyed it. So a decision had to be made so my wife with our 10-day-old daughter was there with my parents, and they decided to remove my right lung. And they had to reconstruct my pulmonary artery. And so that was the story. 3 days later, I wake up and I see like, you know, my family sitting like having a vigil for me, and I was disoriented. I didn't understand what happened. And then the doctor came and explained to me what happened. So keep in mind, I went to sleep thinking that I'm gonna have a blood clot removed. I wake up without a lung and with a lethal cancer. So I had to process that for a bit. And then there was no treatment for it. There was no known chemotherapy treatment because it's so rare. So that was pretty discouraging. And I started looking online and looking at the studies, and I fell upon something that I thought may work, a certain drug in combination with, it was called Olera with doxorubicin, There was a study that showed benefit in end-stage metastatic sarcoma. So I made a mental note that when I'm going to see my oncologist, I'm going to ask him about it. So when I went to Dr. Gary Schwartz in Columbia, so I asked him about this drug, and he said to me, you know, I invented that drug, right? That the study I had read was his study. So I said to him, you know, you're the one guy on the planet I need to talk to. I want to take this drug as a preventive, not to treat metastatic disease, but as prevention. So he said, oh, I'm thinking about doing a study like that in a year. I said, no, I don't want to wait a year. I want to be around in a year. So I actually convinced him, and I was patient number one in the world to take that combination. And I took it for 9 months, and slowly I started getting better. And I had CAT scans every 6 months, and they were clean. And that went on for 2.5 years. And then 6 months ago, during all this pandemic, I went for a routine CAT scan, and they found a recurrent tumor. My pulmonary artery attached to my heart valve, and I needed to have another open heart surgery. They had to replace the heart valve, again, reconstruct the pulmonary artery, and then I had spread to my hip. I needed to do radiation on the hip, and then I had to restart chemo, which I'm on now. So in the middle of going through this rather dramatic health crisis, being a father of eight, dealing with a global pandemic, being the tip of the spear, I have to say, it was only with the grace of God that I was able to keep it all together. And I feel good. And I've been very active. I even though I can't see patients like I used to, but I do a lot of telemedicine. But more importantly, I do research and I teach and I do interviews and I spread awareness. That's really why I'm doing this video interview with you, because we're living through a propaganda war right now. There are forces at play that have suppressed life-saving information, have suppressed access to life-saving medication. So I published a study with two German researchers, Dr. Roland Derwent and Dr. Martin Schulz. They're world-class researchers from Germany, and they called me. They wanted to bring my data to the world. And so we did, and it got published in the internationally renowned peer-reviewed journal. And it showed the following. This is very important, that if you use the Zelenko protocol, which is defined as the following, risk stratify patients. I didn't have to treat everyone. I only treated the high-risk patients, because the low-risk patients all got better without any intervention. It's the high-risk patients, the older patients or patients with medical problems, that have 7.5% mortality rate. So I cherry-picked those patients, and I treated them immediately upon presentation based on clinical symptoms. And then I treated them with hydroxychloroquine, zinc, azithromycin. Subsequently, I started incorporating ivermectin, steroids, blood thinners. You know, medicine is a living, breathing thing, and as more information becomes available, it's very important to be flexible and to incorporate new technologies and new knowledge for the betterment of the patient. So you can't be too rigid. But the principle of early intervention of high-risk patients stay. And my data showed an 84% reduction in hospitalization and death in the high-risk population. Let me rephrase it. At that time, we had a cohort of 3,000 patients with COVID. I risk stratified and treated medically only 1,000 of them. At a 7.5% death rate, you would statistically predict 75 dead people. I had 3 dead people. So that was you know what that implies? That means end of pandemic. That's what it means. And I came across terrible opposition. I got defamed in the media, slandered. I lost my position where I was working because of the political pressures. I got cancer. My wife was always mad at me because I was never home. So it was, and you know, I was going out to my office, really every time thinking it was going to be the last time I see my family, because we didn't know much at that time. And I'm on chemo. I have one lung. You know, it was like, I kind of resolved that I'm all in. This is, you know, this is my responsibility to try to help as many people as I can. So my personal struggles prepared me to think outside the box, meaning if there's no treatment, then find one. That's what I did for my own personal health, and that's what I had to do for COVID. And then not to be afraid, and that's important, because there was a stage after my surgery, my first surgery, where I thought I was going to die. Well, everyone thought I was going to die, and I was preparing to say goodbye to my family. And so psychologically, I'd already made a transition to prepare myself to leave this world and to meet God, which is a very surreal state to be in. But something very interesting happened then. I stopped fearing human beings. And then God decided he didn't want to see me yet. So what's interesting, that lack of fear of human beings stayed with me. And that is a very important element, because I stepped on the toes of the most lethal and diabolical, nefarious people on the planet, which is the liberal left before a presidential election, trying to displace Trump. Because the president recommended the use of hydroxychloroquine. And if hydroxychloroquine ended up being part of the solution, that's a huge political win for the president right before a critical election. So they started, so hydroxychloroquine developed a political side effect. It became politically toxic. So everything was, all the energies were of the media were directed at vilifying this drug in order to not give the president a win. So for me to advocate for it made me an enemy of the liberal left. And also the treatment that I developed cost $20. And it's generic and you can take it by mouth and it's safe. And that was a poke in the eye to the pharmaceutical industry, because they had invested in vaccines and in inpatient expensive therapeutics. So just to explain to you, let's say remdesivir, it was $3,200 a patient treatment. My approach removed or would have taken away 84% of the market share for remdesivir. And in many ways makes the vaccine a moot point. So I really had some very powerful enemies, and I got death threats. You know, it goes with the territory. But then I realized it actually touched even more deeper societal issues. There seems to be opportunists or people with agenda that want to hijack a crisis for their own agenda, like restructuring society. And what this pandemic did, it created global fear. No, there's no treatment, you're gonna die. Economies are shut down, people wearing masks. It was a very traumatizing time for humanity. And what I had stumbled upon, besides treating COVID, gave people hope that you don't have to die. And if you do get sick, we have a safe, effective option, so relax. And that was probably my biggest sin, so to speak. Because whoever was relying on fear as a tool, as a weapon, I became an impediment to. So the war forces that fermented anarchy, chaos, riots, we can discuss who they are later, but it was very difficult, I have to say, to fight against the entire world for months. Fortunately, colleagues started coming on board slowly. And I wasn't a lone voice anymore. And my data was being reproduced by other physicians in different parts of the country and in different countries and different continents. And basically, there's a clear consensus now that pre-hospital treatment of high-risk patients with various combinations of drugs, it doesn't have to be my exact protocol, because there's many ways to get to a positive outcome. Medicine is an art. But the key is treat people early that are high risk, has become really the unofficial standard of care with anyone with a half a brain. So that's kind of my story, how that evolved. Now I'm just basically an activist, an advocate for unnecessary death. I really am talking to many countries. I'm supposed to speak to yesterday spoke to the top people in Brazil who are interested in my approach. I think the entire country of Hungary is following Honduras is following my protocol, part of the Ukraine. I tried to convince the Israelis, but they don't listen. A few other countries. So I'm just pushing ahead, trying to spread life-saving knowledge to as many people as possible. I've been censored. I had 163,000 Twitter followers in just a few months, and my tweets were getting 10 million impressions each. And then they just threw me off because whatever. They said platform manipulation, which I don't even know what that is, but they tried to silence me. So I developed a website that has all the information, and I've been free. And I send whoever wants to get access to those protocols, been downloaded, all the research studies, patient testimonials. So it's a very useful resource, and I recommend anyone who needs information to look at it.
Mention the name of your website, please.
Oh, it's my name. It's Vladimir Zelenko, MD.com. Vladimir Zelenko, MD.com.
I think this is one of the most important moving interviews and meeting of a human being in my entire life, sir.
I'm just Zev. You know, my Hebrew name is Zev. I take one day at a time. I live with a very real sense of how precious time is, what a commodity it is, that you can't buy it, and health. And, you know, I can walk without pain. I can breathe now. You know, that wasn't the case for a long time. I don't take that for granted anymore. So I actually found a higher level of serenity going through. And I wrote an autobiography, and one of the last chapters I wrote, I thank God for giving me cancer. And like, people look at me like I'm crazy. But what I mean by that is I would never ask to get cancer, and open heart surgery twice, radiation, chemo twice. But the appreciation for the moment, the appreciation for life and the precious nature of life, and not to squander time, was something that I only discovered through going through my own personal medical struggles. And I no longer run all the time, you know. I know how to stop, withdraw into myself, and just appreciate being, just to be, and that how precious that is. And it takes some mindfulness to get there. But so I feel that there are many hidden fruits and blessings that came through it, although I would never ask for it to go through it again. But no one asked me. So
one of the things you said is just echoing in my mind, in my heart. You said, I stopped fearing human beings. That is so deep. And Ginger and I have been talking a lot about that. We're getting more and more active in this area. And that's a really deep understanding, I think, for people to get. That if you believe in God, if you have higher values, if you're devoted to serving God or humanity, you end up either giving up fearing human beings or you succumb to fear. And it's just, you just put it so to the point in a way I hadn't quite ever put it for myself. But it's what I believe and what I've struggled with for a long, long time.
We're all trying to get higher levels of understanding. You know, after me finding the serenity and understanding was not a simple process, especially after getting cancer, because there were a lot of paradoxes. Here I am discovering an approach that really could end the plague and save humanity, and simultaneously I get recurrent metastatic cancer. The community that I served had the lowest death rate of any comparable community in the world, and that community spit me out because of politics after being there for two decades. So there were a lot of, you know who Piaget is, obviously, right? He described how children learn. And he says that every infant is born with an innate understanding of the rules of being an infant. And then as they begin to develop, they come across anomalies. Like, for example, if you see a child with a toy and you just go and take the toy, the other child will hit you on the head. So you realize that my previous rules were insufficient. I have to develop a higher order level of abstraction to be able to incorporate the new rules with old rules. And that's a process of learning that we go on and on and on and on. So I hit an anomaly. My theology, my understanding of life was insufficient to incorporate the following, that I had a 10-day-old infant, which was a tremendous blessing to, my wife was in her mid-40s, it was a big gift, and simultaneously, I'm going for open-heart surgery. So it was, it's the same God, and if I believe it, that everything is, he does is good, so giving the infant was good, and giving me cancer is good. But I didn't see how giving me cancer was good. You know what I mean? So it created a, I couldn't put it together, you know? It took me a lot of, I went through all these different stages of grieving, you know? Denial and anger and bargaining and then depression. And finally, acceptance. And it's the acceptance of the following, that I should only worry about things that I can control, which is very little. I can control how I think, how I speak, how I act, but that's about it. And whether I'm going to live or die, or how long I'm going to live or die, it's really, no one's asking me. So for me to worry about that is a waste of energy. And I didn't have much energy. I didn't have much extra energy. So I decided, okay, whatever energy I do have, I'm going to use in a productive way and not waste it on things that I can't control. Very useful skill, by the way. And a certain serenity just came over me. And I just said, thank God. I just took off all these fears that had plagued me. And I could focus on the now and the beauty of my family and helping people. And I started to live. Yeah.
Thank you for all what you're talking about today. It's going to be, it's very good for me, and I'm going to make sure that Ginger watches this. And have you expressed yourself this deeply anywhere else? Am I honored to be among a rare group with this interview?
Well, you have a certain demeanor that brings out this type of conversation, obviously. You give space for other people to be, and that makes it easier to express yourself. I've done hundreds of interviews by now, but a lot of times the person interviewing me is more interested in hearing himself than what I have to say. So that doesn't allow for too much space to speak. But people just focus on the controversies and the, maybe it's the science, but the spiritual and the that I'm a human being that went through. It's a blur, but all this interest, like unusually dramatic, I would say, circumstances this year. to probe those feelings. And, you know, it's something maybe I discuss with my wife, but not with many other people. So it's kind of cathartic. I really appreciate it. Thank you. I should send you a check.
I should send you bounteous gifts. I mean it. Tell the folks, I don't think you got to talk about meeting you know who.
So I actually never met the president directly, but I became very close with Rudy Giuliani. And I usually don't talk about patients, but he gave me permission. So I had treated him for prophylaxis. And then indirectly had influence on other people's treatments. So we'll leave it at that. But what's interesting, I just met Rudy Giuliani last week in Washington. And something was plaguing me because he did get COVID and he got sick. And I was wondering, like, what, I guess my protocol doesn't work, or it doesn't work that often, or maybe I needed higher dosing. I didn't know what happened. I didn't know what's up. So I came to his hotel room. We had at least I had a few drinks of scotch, and we were having a good time. And he tells me, you know, I stopped taking it 2 weeks before. He told me I could say that, by the way. So I said, that it made sense. So I see that it actually does work. But he's
Did your work influence the president's taking hydroxychloroquine after he was exposed, or any other aspect of his life?
Well, he admitted it outright. There was a press conference when the president announced he was taking hydroxychloroquine, if you remember. And then he said, I got a letter from a doctor who told me about his experiences. And, you know, he didn't even want to have dinner with me in the White House. He didn't want anything. He just wanted to say, Mr. President, this is what I'm seeing. It was a very well-crafted letter. So that was my letter. I had sent it to him. It got to him. He read it. And then he, on international television, said that he's taking hydroxychloroquine and zinc for prophylaxis. But he only did that for 2 weeks, and then he stopped. I don't know why. But I had contact with Dr. Sean Connolly, the White House doctor, and we had discussed things, you know. I became actually a very nice person, became close to him. So, yeah. I had some international, like the president of Brazil, President Bolsonaro.
And he is a Trump supporter kind of guy, isn't he? He's in that direction, right?
Yes, he is. He took one of my YouTube videos, and then national Brazilian television began to translate it. And he ended up following my protocol when he got sick.
That's wonderful. It's just amazing. The influence that you've had on the world is just incredible. I think this is going to be an important video for people spiritually and also scientifically, though, because even though I've got all these other great people talking about the treatment regimen, somehow when you talk about it, it just comes out with a simplicity and a clarity because you're going through your personal steps of discussing it. So this is going to, this show has covers all of this, the whole thing.
I do want to point out something, that our higher educational system does not teach critical thought and does not teach deductive reasoning or skills of analysis. Rather, it's indoctrination and to train people to respond to stimuli like Pavlovian dogs. And the reason why I say that is that those physicians that followed the paradigm of early intervention their whole career, the same physicians would refuse to treat patients with COVID-19 with a drug because they might kill them as they were writing this prescription for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis to another patient. And I looked at it and I said, what is going on here? What happened to common sense? What happened to people's minds? And I realized that we train robots, we train automatons. We don't train people able to take a step back and just use some logic and deductive reasoning. And if there's a new situation that we haven't dealt with, use skills that you already have to try to come up with a solution that's effective. And I wish that changes. And one of my most rewarding things that's happened, I had a ton of medical students call me, and they just said that I was a real inspiration for them. And I think that's great, because in the beginning of their careers, to be able to influence their thought processes, and who knows how many people they'll help, I find that very important. So that's what I'm saying.
I love the background family sounds.
Yeah. Thank God. The little kids. They're the joy of my life, and I appreciate the little things now. You know, I just to change a diaper even is a it's not a chore. It's a opportunity to connect. Hey, Shira, come say hi. Come.
Well, that would be lovely.
This is Libo.
Hi. Handsome.
She's a girl.
She's beautiful.
She's a year and a half. Where she is. You want to come? Come. Come, come. And that's Shira. Come. Come.
Shira. Marisha! Hi. Big voice.
She's over there. So she's almost three.
You're the one I've been listening to during the interview. Oh. Smile. I got a smile out of you.
Marcia's calling me.
Shira, I'm Dr. Breggin, Peter Breggin. I love your father. I admire your father so much. Yeah. Can you see me real clear?
Yeah.
I wanted an answer from Shira.
She's one and a half, so.
She doesn't talk yet.
She knows.
She just looks like she's knowing. Yeah. You look to me like you're knowing. Look at that smile I'm getting from you. I did not know it, Dr. Zelenko, but Ginger, when she first came to be with me 35 years ago, she said, do you know when you walk into a restaurant or a room, all the children's heads whip around? Even the infants in arms, they whisper around. I said, that's ridiculous. And then we went out to an activity in my son's school, and all of a sudden there were children standing around me. She said, you see the children standing around you? And I feel like I'm getting that right now. There's just this wonderful look coming back.
You know, you have a certain demeanor that creates a sense of safety. And I think, yeah.
Thank you. Hi. We have about, I guess, 6 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes. I don't think that we need to move toward a crescendo. It happened for me somewhere in the middle of this talk. I guess I've had so much feeling. I want to say that.
What was the question?
Well, it wasn't a question so much as the issues. I want my wonderful audience to know that the issues that you are talking about are what Ginger and I talk about almost every night now. And, you know, we're really afraid that we're losing America right now, and I suspect you share that fear. How do you relate to that? Could you talk about that for a little bit? How are you relating to what's going on in the country right now? If you feel comfortable with that, otherwise, I mean, you've already shared so much.
And what I see is that the holy has become profane, and the profane has become holy. The truth is perceived as lies, and lies are perceived as truth. And it's a... There is a theological war at play here between God-centered, focused living and that of anxiety and enslavement to human beings. And we're being asked, each one of us individually, how do we want to live? Do we want to... I believe that anxiety lives in the psychological space where God is not. Because if I say to you, Doctor, happy birthday, you'll say, wait, it's not my birthday. But what I actually am trying to say is that every second, nanosecond, is an act of recreation ex nihilo. So since you're being actively recreated every moment, so then it's your birthday. The reason why that's important, because that brings God into a very intimate relationship with you, and then you're never alone. And if you don't feel alone, you don't feel anxiety. And if you don't feel anxiety, then nefarious forces can't put their yoke on you. There's only one, there's a saying I like, there's only one type of free person in this world, someone who chooses to be a slave to God. Mm-hmm. I choose to bow down to the creator of the universe, but by doing so, the yoke of my own inadequacies and other people's thoughts of me and those of people with their own evil agendas doesn't affect me, at least directly. And I'm able to disregard them or see through their motives. So
I think what you just said is one of the most profound things I've ever heard about God and space and anxiety. Would you say some more about that?
Well, it's something I figured out from personal experience. It's, it's not because I read it in a book. It's when you live with paralyzing fear that you're going to die. And actually, I wasn't so afraid of dying. I was afraid, what's going to happen to my kids? Yeah. And then, when around 12 years ago, I ran the volunteer EMS system in my community. And I'd seen a two-year-old child crushed by a car. The head was completely crushed. And I had to tell the family that the child died. And at that time, I had a two-year-old child at home, and it really messed with my head. And I became a little bit like obsessive. I would call to see are the kids okay. And then a rabbi friend of mine said something to me, which actually helped me later on in my life, that God loves my kids more than I love my kids. And that kind of took this need to micromanage everything off of me. And I realized that if God chooses to take me, so his calculations are perfect. So he, whatever my children will need to go through associated with that has been factored in. So it took off that angst off of me as well and freed my soul up to focus on here and now. So it's interesting how life experiences change you and steer you in the correct direction. And I, many times we go on detours, and it's like on the highway, you have those ridges, and if you're falling asleep and you go to the side, it gives you a little shake, you make a course correction. That's how I view things. And the key is to find the path towards living a righteous life. Divine life, a blessed life.
One of the things that you said earlier when you were talking about how you were an atheist because of, part of you thought you were God, and before I readopted my notion of that there is a God, one of my patients was feeling sad for me because she said, I see you're lonely, Peter, and you don't believe in God. And I said, well, that's true. She was a Catholic. And I said, my notion of the only thing I know about God is it's not me. She said, oh, you're on your way. She said. And then when you talked about that, it reminded me of this good and evil we're facing right now. And I think we're facing people who think they're God.
Yeah.
That's the left. The left thinks it's the God of humanity.
Yeah, they know better. That's what they think.
Have you ever been, anybody ever suggest to you that you, God's endowed you as a prophet for our time?
Am I
the first person? Am I the first person?
I don't know what I am. I really, this is Zev. I don't, look, it's important. I started this interview giving acknowledgement. See, being a Jew or a human being is a paradox because you have to try your best, your hardest. You have to be the smartest, the richest, the most, everything. But simultaneously acknowledge that you're nothing and everything's from God. So it's a paradox because humility is a very important trait because it makes you a conduit for inspiration. And if you're full of yourself, then, well, that's what you get. So I feel happiest when I feel myself the least.
God bless you. Folks, we have to end now. And this has been the most profound hour conversation I've ever had with anyone. And I thank you so, so much for that. So much for that. With all my heart, I thank you for this interview. Dr. Zev Zelenko.